Organizations designed to get girls excited about engineering have been around for a while, but new research shows that 40% of women who do get engineering degrees either leave the profession or never even enter the field. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Women in Engineering. Amy Bix is the author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. I'll talk with her about why the gender gap in engineering endures and some notable individuals who've worked to close that gap. And Janice Marcourt of the Society of Women Engineers will give us a glimpse inside the workplace. We also want to hear from you this hour. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, women in engineering, and we're going to start with a look back. Engineering was once considered to be a job for men and only men. There is still a gender gap in engineering, but that gap has closed a great deal over the years. Amy Bix is the author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. She's also an associate professor of history at Iowa State University, and she's with us now. Hello, Amy.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, what was it that got you interested in looking in depth into the history of engineering education for women specifically?
Well, the truth is we know a fair amount about the history of women in science. And if you ask just a casual person, a friend, a neighbor, to name a famous woman in science, 9 times out of 10, at least they'll come up with Marie Curie. We also know a fair amount about the history of women in medicine, the history of women as doctors, nurses, other healers, and patients. But when it comes to women in engineering, we really haven't known that much. And as it turns out, the history of women in engineering is significantly different from the history of women in either of the sister fields, science or medicine.
That is fascinating because we do tend to lump all of those fields together, particularly when we're talking about STEM education and encouraging girls to go into non-traditional fields as they look at education and their future. In your research, what did you find was the difference? I mean, and let's, for example, let's look at medicine. Why do you think women made strides in medicine so far before they made strides in engineering?
Well, historically, going back to ancient times, really, as far as we can see, women have always had a role in healing. And there have always been roles for women as midwives. In medieval times, nuns had a healing role. Then in the 1800s, you have some women who enter medical education here in the United States and in Europe, often in alternative medicine, which was sometimes more welcoming than mainstream medicine. And by the time you get to the early 20th century, you have some specific medical schools set up specifically just to train women to become doctors. So you have those paths for women into medicine. And then, of course, nursing, right from the beginning, was gender linked to women. So you have those ways that women can move into medicine where you don't have that for women in engineering.
And how about in other scientific fields? Why were women more welcome there?
Well, it wasn't always easy for women. Many of them were, in fact, blocked or limited. But again, when you look back, you can find women who managed to get a foothold in the sciences, often by working through a man in the family. So, for example, the early astronomer Caroline Herschel gets started as an assistant to her brother. Then she acquires her own telescope and begins doing her own work. Similarly, the chemist Marie Lavoisier, she starts out as an assistant to her husband. Then you get the women's colleges in the United States, Holyoke, Wellesley, Vassar. They give women degrees in science starting in the 1800s, but none of those women's colleges taught engineering. So again, there are big differences there.
It was very interesting in reading your book. For me, I guess I've always thought about this education gap, but the education gap between women and men in the United States is not as wide, or was not as wide, as I imagined it to be. Looking at going way back in 1870, 21% of undergraduates in the United States were women. 1880, 32%. By 1910, just under 40%. By the 1920s, 47% of undergraduates were women. Were you surprised at all, looking back, at finding that women were involved in higher education at higher numbers than you might have imagined?
Well, that's a great question. This connects very nicely with broader women's history. Really, starting in the early 1800s especially, you had a number of advocates, both women and male allies, who pushed to give women access to education. So that was a big issue even before, for example, the right to vote. That was still extremely controversial in many, many quarters. But giving women access to education, that's something that a lot of people were comfortable with, in part because it could be justified by saying that if you gave women access to education, they'd be better able to teach their own children. And then there's the occupation opening up of being a school teacher. So the idea that women could help build the country through their feminine roles as wives and mothers and teachers, that's a justification for opening broader education to women. But again, that doesn't work for engineering, because in the 1800s, engineering really wasn't something that you needed a college degree for much of the time. Many engineers entered the field without formal book learning. Instead, they might get training, for example, by going to work on the Erie Canal or going to work on a railroad shop. They learned as they went. But of course, those places, the military, industry, construction, those were basically closed to women. So that avenue of opportunity doesn't work for them.
It's so interesting to think about how the field of engineering has changed so dramatically. I mean, the way you're describing it at that point in time, it was somewhat a blue-collar job.
Oh, yes. And there's a woman named Ruth Oldenseal who's done some excellent work on the early gendering of engineering in the 1800s and the 20th century. If you look at the way engineers talked about themselves and were portrayed in the early 20th century, they portray it as an explicitly macho profession. These are the guys who are going out and building bridges through the Amazon and conquering the desert by building roads and bringing progress and civilization. So you have that whole masculine image, and you have the toys that support that, the Erector sets, the Meccano, the Lion train sets that are explicitly marketed toward training boys to grow up to become engineers.
Well, and at that time, engineering was a much more physical job than it is for most engineers today, who spend a lot of time sitting and looking at computer screens. But I'm sure that that also reinforced the gender divide.
Oh, absolutely. The profession of engineering has changed, and that's one of the interesting things, to see the way engineers' self-definition of the field and the way they promote it to young people, how that's evolved over the decades.
So I guess it's not surprising that there was this deep divide at the beginning of the 20th century. But as things began to change, when you started looking into women who did seek out engineering education, you found the word invaders to be used quite a lot. So when women started to want to enter engineering, what were the responses?
Well, that's it exactly. At the end of the 1800s and the early 20th century, you get a handful of women, just really one or two or three at a time, trying to move into engineering studies at the places that were open to them. At that time, there are still many schools, including some of the ones that I study, Georgia Tech and Caltech, that don't admit women, period. But there are other schools, coeducational schools, where women have the option, including our own Iowa State. And so, at Iowa State, it becomes possible for a woman to show up on campus to say, hey, I've grown up around the farm, helping my dad fix his Model T, working with the farm machinery. I think I'd like to become an engineer. And sometimes it works, but other times, probably with the best intentions in the world, the engineering zine will say, no, you'd be the only woman here. You wouldn't really be comfortable. Why don't we go over to home economics and study home equipment? But you do get a handful of women, one or two at a time, studying engineering at places like Iowa State and Cornell. And this was something that struck me when I started doing the research. You do get this word invade used over and over again in descriptions of these women entering engineering. It's such an emotionally loaded word, and it implies a large volume invasion when really it's just one or two women at a time. And that really tells you the extent to which the men saw these women as outsiders coming into a field that had never been meant for them.
And in addition to seeing these women as outsiders, there was a lot of stereotyping going on as well. I mean, these women were seen as not feminine and not engineers. So they were sort of stuck on both sides.
Yes, that's it exactly. Basically, as engineers, they weren't really considered proper women. And as women, they weren't really considered proper engineers.
So I know that you didn't want to go back and write a serial biography of all of the women who broke into the field of engineering. But are there a couple of women who really stand out to you from those early years?
Well, really, some of my favorites are the group of women who are known as the Curtiss-Wright Cadets. That happens during World War II. Most people are familiar with Rosie the Riveter, where industry had to bring in women to take over the assembly lines when there was a manpower shortage. But industry also desperately needed engineers. So they want to hire women engineers during World War II, but they simply haven't had enough trained. So you get this crash program at Iowa State and six other schools to train women in aeronautical engineering to work for the Curtiss-Wright Company. So all of a sudden, you have 700 women during the war studying flight theory, aircraft engineering. Here at Iowa State, they have giant headlines, train women in engineering. It makes such news.
Now, of course, World War II changed so much about our culture, and I can imagine that a lot of women who were faced with brand new opportunities for working outside the home, brand new career opportunities, but also looking at our changing world, the idea of being an engineer at that point, I would guess, was a lot more exciting for men and women. Do we see a lot more women trying to become engineers after World War II?
You do see an increase. Proportionately, they're still vastly outnumbered by the men, because, of course, then you get into the Cold War, the Sputnik era, with the national push to increase science and technical education. So the number of women pursuing engineering degrees does rise after World War II, but because the number of men also rises, they remain less than 1% of the total.
And we talked earlier about how medicine and other scientific fields seem to be easier for women to make their way into. At that point, with more women perhaps looking in that direction, did they gravitate toward those other fields because there was an easier entree?
Well, easier being relative. There's still lots of obstacles for women in science and medicine in the post-war years, as well as this country kind of reverting back to a more conservative social outlook when it comes to gender roles. So it's not easy for women in science then either.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Amy Bix. She is the author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. We'll talk more about this history in a moment, and we'll also get a look inside the modern day workplace for women engineers. And we want to hear from you. What's your story? What's your experience? 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about women in engineering, and we want to hear about your experiences as well. Are you a woman who studied engineering? Do you work in the field today? Did you leave the field? Perhaps you're a student. You can share your experiences at 866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me right now is Amy Bix. She's the author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. She's also an associate professor of history at Iowa State University. And Amy, before the break, we'd gotten kind of through World War II and talked about socially conservative 1950s. So things started to really change in the 1960s and into the 1970s. How are things changing for women who wanted to become engineers?
Well, the first thing that happens is that some of the schools specializing in engineering that had been male only begin to open to women. And it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen easily. So I'm particularly interested in a couple of case studies. One of the ones that I look at is Georgia Tech. Now, Georgia Tech didn't have the Curtis Wright Cadet Program to train women to study engineering during World War II. So in the post-war period, Georgia Tech continues to be what it had been, which is a school that very much associates engineering with masculine traditions. And as a matter of fact, part of the way they define being a Georgia Tech student and being an engineer was by making fun of women. You look at the campus magazines, and they have all sorts of cartoons that ridicule the whole idea of women engineers. Well, the problem is, of course, Georgia Tech as a public school was under a certain amount of pressure. There was a test case, a young high school woman in Georgia who was very interested in studying engineering, but because Georgia Tech was all male, she literally had no place to go in her home state. So this reaches Atlanta women's organizations. They threaten to file a lawsuit. The Georgia Tech president, as it happens at that time, had both a wife and a daughter who were technically skilled. So he's torn. He knows how much Georgia Tech has historically identified engineering with masculinity, but he personally wants to support women in engineering. So he manages to maneuver, and under that threat of lawsuits, Georgia Tech begins to grudgingly admit women to a few programs in the 1950s. Similarly, Caltech becomes coeducational in 1970, and that's a whole different complicated story. They're a private school, so they don't have the legal pressure. Instead, Caltech begins admitting women because their male undergraduates have gotten restless at an all-male school. They compare Caltech to a monastery. They say it turns out brilliant scientists and engineers who are social idiots, who have no idea even how to talk to women, so they're getting restless. It ties into the whole late 1960s student unrest, demanding more autonomy on campus. And for that reason, Caltech winds up going coeducational in 1970. They make all the right noises about the justice of opening programs to women, but in reality, they never expected women to become brilliant scientists and engineers in the same numbers as men. They did it simply to keep their male undergraduates happy.
Oh,
so the first step first is for women to find places in programs. MIT technically had been coeducational since the late 1800s, but it isn't until the 1960s, with pressure particularly from the feminist movement and other male allies, that MIT begins opening up its programs more to women and trying to make them more comfortable on campus.
At the same time, the engineering culture passed the educational part of it. I mean, engineering company culture was also incredibly masculine and male dominated. You share some really remarkable examples of, for example, there's an advertisement, and this is from Douglas Aeronautics, a 1966 ad. And they bill themselves as an equal opportunity employer, but there's a picture of a man at a drafting table, and it says, intrigued by exotic designs, and he is drawing a model of a naked woman in flight. And this was in 1966.
That's the amazing thing. You look at some of the advertising from mainstream companies, some of the mainstream engineering magazines, and that sexism is right out there. Again, it's become part of the fabric, part of the tradition in engineering. They don't consciously critique it. But then the amazing thing is you see that change almost overnight in the late 60s, early 70s with the development of civil rights law. All of a sudden, overnight, you get ads from these firms recruiting women engineers, talking about how they already have female engineers on their staff, what great opportunities they give them. So it's remarkable, that transformation.
Now, that's what we're seeing in print, but what do we know about how things transformed in the workplace?
Well, again, as you say, rhetoric is one thing, actual practice is another. And this is where women's experiences differ so greatly. Talking to female engineering students and women engineers today, I run into plenty who say, I've never had any problems, I feel perfectly accepted, and that's terrific. More power to them. I hope that continues. But then you do run into others who give the depressing experiences of feeling the pressure, not being taken seriously, having trouble juggling work and family, not having access to promotions or equal pay. So the story does get complicated. And as you say, those questions continue today.
And I went to college in the 1990s. I had a lot of female friends who went into engineering. I went to Iowa State University, and it feels like everybody's an engineer when you're there. And even at that point, there were a lot of programs that were trying to encourage young women to go into scientific and engineering fields. But I think a lot of us took it for granted that that was our opportunity, that that was a choice that we could make. And is that the sense in education today, that a lot of young women who want to go into engineering just take it for granted that that's an opportunity that it's open to them?
Oh, yes. You know, I imagine most young women today don't realize how recently it was that schools such as Caltech wouldn't even look at their applications. So it's terrific that you and women today do take that opportunity for granted. But it's important to look back at the history and realize how we got those programs that exist today.
I'm talking with Amy Bix. She is the author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kathy is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm calling because I wonder if it... if there's different branches of engineering that are better at attracting, keeping women. It's actually my son is an engineer from MIT. He got his degree a couple of years ago. The head of his lab was a woman. All three members of his dissertation committee were women. And I think probably two-thirds of the lab were women. But this was biomedical engineering. And I wondered if maybe... you know, you've been talking more of like Rosie the Riveter, nuts and bolts, building bridges, that kind of thing. Does it make a difference what branch you're in as far as retention and attractiveness to women?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really glad you brought that up. There is, in fact, a substantial difference when you look at specific fields. Some fields, chemical engineering, as you mentioned, biomedical engineering, environmental engineering, have historically attracted relatively high numbers of women, while other subfields of engineering have struggled more. And actually, it's kind of interesting. In the 1970s, when the environmental movement really began expanding, there were a number of people who looked at that and thought that would be a way of actually attracting more women into engineering, with the idea that women were particularly concerned with the environment and the social impact of engineering. So they saw the different specialties of engineering as having different gender appeal.
And if you look across classes today, you still see that?
Oh, yes. There are still plenty of women that I encounter in certain specialties where they get to their upper level classes and they look around and they're still the only woman sitting in class. So it does depend.
Kathy, thank you so much for your call. And I want to bring Janice Marcourt into the conversation now. She is a member of the Society of Women Engineers. She is a senior buyer from Mid-American Energy and has had a varied career. She's here to give us some insight into the life of a working woman engineer. Hello, Janice.
Hello. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And now you started your undergraduate career in 2002. And engineering was one of your focuses. What attracted you to the field?
Well, I actually was raised in a family full of engineers, and I think that makes a huge difference. My parents are divorced and remarried, and of my four parents, three of them have engineering degrees. Three of them have PhDs, and the last one has a computer science PhD. So I was brought up in that kind of a culture, and I've always been a little bit hardwired to be kind of an engineer. I want to know how things work. I want to change the world. I want to be challenged. All of those sorts of things have always attracted me to the field. And I went in as an undecided engineer, and Amy was talking about the different fields of engineering. And I went in undecided, and I settled on mechanical engineering as what I liked to do. But it was nice to go in undecided because Iowa State did a really good job of letting me know what the different fields meant and how what they each did and that sort of thing.
And studying in 2002, did you feel like you were in the minority in engineering still?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I definitely felt like I was in the minority. However, the Society of Women Engineers, or SWE, as we usually refer to it, really has a lot of really good support systems. And so I joined this community of other female engineering students, and I spent most of my time among that community and didn't I mean, yes, I noticed that there was usually one other girl in most of my classes, the smaller classes. But I did notice that there were not many women. But I knew that going in, and SWE does a really good job of helping with that. It was really only once I hit the workplace that I felt that a lot more strongly.
Can you give me an example once you hit the workplace of how you felt that more strongly?
Well, I pretty much got to the point where in classes or in, trainings, I should say, or in conference rooms, I was almost always the only woman in the room. My perspective did tend to be different as a design engineer, and I got some pretty strange looks sometimes. There was one time we were designing a machine, and I used my sewing machine as an example for how we could design this particular component of the machine. I was like, oh, like a sewing machine, it could work like this. And you wouldn't believe the looks I got from the other guys in the room. They were like, a sewing machine? So there was definitely kind of a at that moment, I was very aware of the fact that I was female and the fact that I would use a sewing machine as a metaphor for how to design this component of this very large piece of steel really drove that home a little bit.
Did you find that your ideas weren't taken as seriously as ideas of male colleagues?
I wish I could say no, but I will say yes. I did find there were several times where I had ideas on how to design components or how to run things. Some of that was my youth. I mean, I'd only been working for a couple of years, so some of it was inexperience in general.
Sure.
But yeah, I will say definitely that there were other men in the room who had relatively the same amount of youth and were taken much more seriously than my ideas were. Like I said, I would like to say that that was not the case, and I tend to be a very outspoken woman, and so I'm not shy to express those ideas, but I will say that there were a lot of times that those ideas fell on deaf ears.
Have you had experiences where people were surprised by the knowledge that you have?
Oh, absolutely, all the time.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, well, and actually once I came into procurement, I'm in purchasing now, which is obviously a non-engineering field. I had a salesperson come talk to me about some new steel alloy that he had, and it was for some component he was trying to sell me. And I said, well, can I see the spec sheet on that? And I took a look at it, and I said, oh, well, you know, this is just a chrome moly steel. And he kind of went a little white. He was definitely surprised by the fact that I knew something about steel in procurement, but also I think the female thing did have an effect on that. And in his defense, I don't think he understood it wasn't something special. I think he'd been told it was. And the ability to do that has been really helpful in my purchasing career, the ability to know a little bit more about the product that I'm buying has helped me a lot. So my technical field is helpful.
So when you were working as a technical engineer, was it also a physical job?
In my case, yes. And not every company is that way. But the company I was working for, the engineers actually build prototypes, turn wrenches, even weld. I am a certified welder, although I'm not any good at it. But I am a certified welder, and we built our prototypes. So it was a very physical job. And there were definitely times when I'm not a very large woman, and so my physical stature, being able to literally move the steel around and drill holes in steel, that was something I really struggled with. You know, I have a drill, I have the tools I need, but you have to kind of bring your weight to bear when you're drilling a hole through steel. And there was one time that I was just really struggling, and I went to take a break, and I came back, and one of the engineering technicians had just done it for me while I went to the bathroom or whatever I did, and came back 5 minutes later, and it was done, and I'd been struggling with it for 15, 20 minutes.
And was that, did you feel like that was a supportive move, or did you feel...
Well, the other engineer who was teaching me how to drill this hole was not supportive. In the case of the engineering tech, I think he was kind of, taking pity on me. He could see I was struggling with it. It was embarrassing because I knew that if I had been, a guy or bigger or stronger or all of those physical things, that I wouldn't have struggled with it the way I did. And so, yeah, it was a little embarrassing. Yeah.
You also... were working as a technical engineer through your pregnancy.
Yes.
And so you were working on these machines as a pregnant woman. How did that go down in the workroom?
Well, and that was interesting too. I mean, 8 months pregnant, I was literally climbing all over a very large machine. We had a machine we were building that was, 10 foot by 10 foot by 52 foot long, and had a bunch of electric motors. And there was one time I was straddling one of the electric motors and unbolting it from the pump it was attached to. And one of my coworkers walked by, and I'm 8 months pregnant, so I was huge. And he was just like, whoa. And he was fairly supportive. But one of the interesting things was the reactions I got from not only my male counterparts, but also the women who worked on the shop floor. I got everything from, kind of the you go girl kind of attitude to the, oh, you really shouldn't be doing that kind of attitude.
Interesting. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Janice Markart, who is a member of the Society of Women Engineers. She's also a senior buyer for Mid-American Energy. She's worked as a technical engineer in the past. With me also, Amy Bix, author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. And we want to hear from you, too. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We want to hear about your experiences. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about women in engineering, and we would love for you to join the conversation with your experiences and your thoughts at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Amy Bix. She's the author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. She's also Associate Professor of History at Iowa State University, and Janice Markort. She is a member of the Society of Women Engineers. She has worked as a technical engineer. Right now, she is senior buyer for Mid-American Energy. And I want to read an email here. This is from Della. She says, I graduated from the University of Iowa with a degree in civil engineering, and I'm currently working in the field, getting my hands dirty, so to speak. I'm always fascinated by the role that men take in encouraging women to pursue careers in STEM fields. I'm a huge believer that the men in our lives, fathers, husbands, friends, etc., must be our biggest supporters. I've found myself in a room full of professionals being the only female present, but as women, we must not let this scare us. Rather, it must be our encouragement to keep moving forward. And Janice, I would love to have you respond to Della's email. You mentioned there were some very supportive coworkers. There were some that were not as supportive of your role as a technical engineer. Have you had a lot of support from the men in your life?
I would say the men close to me personally, definitely. My husband is a huge supporter of mine. He and I have been together for many, many years, even before college, and so he always knew I was kind of heading toward a technical degree, and we also knew that I was going to make more money than he was. It was likely that I was going to be the breadwinner, and him being okay with that had a huge impact on my ability to do that, because if he had not been my support there, I don't know know what I would have done. And then, like I said, even from when I was little, the men in my life, my father, my stepfather, have been big encouragers of me going into a technical field. My brother ended up graduating with a mechanical engineering degree, although he's younger. But yeah, just having that level of support of the men close to me has been really important. I will say that the men in my professional life, I haven't really met a huge advocate in my male professional in my professional life that was an engineer. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, I want to focus again on your work as a technical engineer in that kind of environment. You're working with a lot of men, a lot of welders, a lot of, I guess, blue collar individuals who are doing kind of the yeoman's work. And one of the things that you found in that environment was that these men would change their behavior because you were around. Can you explain that to me?
Absolutely. Well, there was one engineering technician who swore a lot. He had a very colorful set of language. And that honestly doesn't bother me. It never has bothered me at all. I don't mind if the men swear around me. But he consciously tried to swear less around me. And I once actually confronted him about it. I said, you know, you can swear around me. It really doesn't bother me. And he said, well, my mom always taught me not to swear in front of a lady. And just the fact that he constantly thought of me as not just a female, but a lady, you know, that made it harder to work with him because it did affect how well he respected my opinion on how to do things. And he was very well, you know, he knew his field very, very well, and I have the utmost respect for him. But yeah, there were a lot of times when I would tell him or ask him to do something, and he would kind of run off and go do whatever he thought was the right thing to do anyway. And sometimes it turned out to be the right thing to do, and sometimes it didn't. But he never came to me and said, you know, I don't think that's the right thing to do, and here's why. There was just that level of, you know, kind of like respect, yeah.
Right. So there was he was doing what he felt was right, but that deference to you as a female actually impeded your ability to work with him.
Yes, definitely. But you know, it was true of pretty much all of the engineering techs was that I knew that when I wasn't around, they did a lot more swearing. You know, some of the things that are just masculine things that guys on a shop floor will do. And then, you know, also when I first joined the job, apparently my male colleagues warned, and that was the word I was told, warned them, the technicians, that the new engineer was female. And to be, you know, aware of that, embraced for that. And I would like to see us get to the point where they don't need to be warned, you know, that it's just a matter, of course, of, oh, we have a new engineer. Oh, great. You know, and then who is this person? Oh, it's her name is Janice, whatever. But we're definitely still at the point where, oh, you know, we have a new female we have a new engineer and she's female. So there was kind of this, you know, undercurrent of that.
There was a recent survey that was published or a recent study that was published that shows that the field of engineering in general has a retention problem when it comes to women, that close to 40% of women with engineering degrees either leave the profession or never even become engineers in spite of their degrees. This was a study compiled by Nadia Fuad, who's a psychologist at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And from your experience, Janice, do you find that a lot of your women colleagues leave?
I haven't had a lot of my women colleagues, but I have left. I mean, so I'm a senior buyer now. So I'm one of that 40% in that I'm not working as a design engineer or project engineer. Engineer is not in my title. But yes, I do see there's some exodus involved, and some of it is just it's very wearing to be the only woman in the room for a long period of time, and when you're a young engineer, it's not such a big deal. And you're coming out of college. College has a lot more support systems in place, what I found, than the workplace does. You know, the quote-unquote real world hits you sometimes a little harder. And the realities of having children, having a family, being a breadwinner, or maybe you have a spouse who's also an engineer. There's a lot of engineering couples out there. You know, they meet in college. Having two working engineers in a household can be an extremely challenging thing. And I've seen that in my peers as well. Because engineers do tend to work a little bit longer hours. You know, it's not really long hours, but I don't know very many engineers who work a strict 40-hour week. I haven't met many. There's a few out there. Most of them tend to work more like 45, 50 hours a week because there's a lot to do and their work is challenging and they enjoy it. But that's very wearing on a family life and having a family life. And it's hard not to have someone at home. I have a stay-at-home husband, and that enabled me in a lot of ways to do the engineering job.
Did the workplace environment play into your decision to move on?
Yeah, it did a little bit. I did have a supervisor who was a bit of a micromanager, and he also did have some chauvinistic tendencies, but he was also blocking a lateral move from me into another group. And in a lot of ways, moving into purchasing was something I was interested in, and it turns out I'm very good at, but it was a graceful way out of a situation that didn't have a lot of graceful ways out.
Interesting. I want to go to the phones, and Janice is with us. Also, Amy Bix is still here. She's the author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. And Rochelle is on the line next from Iowa City. Hello, Rochelle.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
I have a daughter who is in fifth grade, and she's incredibly interested in science, engineering, math, and technology. While we have few programs and efforts to recruit older youth who are going into college, there are virtually no programs directed at young youth to follow their goals and dreams in these areas. And I'm wondering what we can do to direct more programs at young youth.
I don't know which one of you wants to tackle
well,
that. Janice, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I'll go first. I will say that there is a... It's true that there are fewer of them. Some of them are kind of hiding. Now, you're in Iowa City, so you have some access to some of those programs. I will actually tell you the Girl Scouts are surprisingly good about this. There are days where they have Society of Women Engineers actually works very well with those age groups, often hosts, you know, the Iowa State University SWE section just hosted a Girl Scout day of math and science type activities in order to earn those math and science badges. I was really pretty impressed with the Girl Scouts and their efforts there. I will also say that Iowa State has quite a few camps, like week-long camps, and your daughter being in fifth grade is just getting to the age where she could do those. And I would highly encourage you to look into them. I'm sure the University of Iowa probably has a few too if she didn't want to go quite so far from home. But there's a lot of really good like young science camps that, you know, they're pretty gender blind. They do a pretty good job of just having them available, their costs being, I think, fairly minimal, not free, but not too bad for price.
Rochelle, thanks a lot for your call. And Amy, did you have anything you wanted to add on that front?
Well, Janice is absolutely on target. The Girl Scouts have done some wonderful things. You know, people sometimes fall into the stereotype of thinking of Girl Scouts as cookies and the traditional homemaker type badge. But if you look now, there are all sorts of fabulous opportunities that they have. Badges to encourage young girls to work with computers, to work on cars, to work with other technology and sciences. And then the school programs. Again, it may take some digging depending on where you are. But either, again, as Janice said, if not in your school, then at schools in the immediate vicinity, they have after-school programs, they have summer camps. And something that I find particularly interesting is that in recent years, you have this kind of mini explosion of toys and kits that are specifically designed to encourage girls to have fun playing with and tinkering with technology. So there are all sorts of robotics clubs and robotics kits out there that young girls and boys can use. There's something called Ruminate, which is kind of fun. It's a dollhouse that girls can wire for themselves, so you can actually wire your own TV set and little lights inside your dollhouse. And there are other do-it-yourself kits for girls. And then there's Engineer Barbie, but that raises a whole different set of questions.
Well, and I'll also put in a plug for Goldieblocks. Goldieblocks are relatively new. They were started as a Kickstarter, and I have a set of them for my daughter, who's 4, and she's just getting to the age where those are interesting to her.
Oh, yes, those are terrific. And they were explicitly designed by a female engineering graduate specifically to encourage young girls around 4, 5, 6 to literally play with technology. They tell stories, and the idea is to encourage the girls to play with the kit that comes with this little book. And they're absolutely wonderful from what I've heard.
Amanda is on the line next in Spencer. Hello, Amanda.
Hello.
Hi, you are an engineer. Your spouse is also an engineer, so you fall into one of the categories that Janice was just talking about a few minutes ago. That sounds like that was a challenge.
It was a challenge. We were actually in the oil industry in Texas, and that was our biggest challenge when we decided to have children, was we can't both work 12-hour days. So, and for us, it wasn't a financial consideration because we were really doing pretty much the same job as the same, you know, same type of job in the same place. And so our incomes were very equal. Actually, I was actually for a time making more than my husband. That's the biggest challenge I see. There were no opportunities for me in that field at that time to work part-time. It was 12-hour days or nothing. And so that's a challenge that I see in some of the other people that have challenged as well. How do I work 12-hour days and have a child? It doesn't really work.
And the study that I mentioned earlier that shows that close to 40% of women in engineering leave the profession or don't practice as engineers pointed that out as one of the major reasons that there's a real lack of work-life balance available in a lot of engineering companies. And I'm sure that's a reason that probably male engineers also struggle with that as well, but it's a particular challenge for female engineers. And Amanda, did you have colleagues that you also saw being forced to make the same kinds of choices?
Well, there weren't a lot of women, but that really wasn't, you know, an oil refinery in Texas, there were very few women. So not really, because I had 2 or 3 other female colleagues and only one other female engineer, and she was younger than me, so I'm not really sure how, you know, as she got older, how she decided to deal with that issue. There are so few women, especially in that type of field, I really didn't have a lot of colleagues that were, you know, I could look and see what they had done.
Amanda, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And Janice, I would guess this resonates with you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what she said about there not really being a part-time option is so true. There really aren't many companies that will let you do part-time engineering. I've known a couple of colleagues through the years that maybe worked like 3 days a week or whatever, but it's extremely challenging to get a supervisor in engineering who will let you do that. It's very rare. And that's an interesting point to bring up, the lack of part-time possibilities, because there are a lot of women who, you know, have children, and when you're in that kind of period where you have an infant or a newborn, really do need to work part-time. And I never had that freedom because I am the sole income in my family. But if I had had a husband who was working, it would have made a pretty big difference to me to be able to do that.
Well, and I just want to point out here that, again, that is a problem for many men as well who would like to spend time with their children and be involved in their children's lives. That can be a huge issue for both men and women. I want to read this email from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. She says, my grandmother was employed by the local ordnance factory during World War II. She hauled loads from one end of the production floor to the other and in general performed heavy labor while her husband, who was too ill with cancer to work, stayed at home with my mother. He also had a knack with electronics and general handyman work and shared his knowledge with my mother, who still amazes me with her practical expertise. As such, I was raised in the fine tradition of the can-do woman who gets things done and doesn't need a man around just to be productive. I was always told stories about how Grandma Ruby could do anything a man could do and was never held back from doing anything or expressing interest in any subject based on my gender. And we need to leave it there today, but that speaks to something that you wrote about, Amy Bix, with there were a lack of role models for women who were interested in going into engineering, but there are many role models out there today, aren't there?
Oh, yes, very important ones.
All right, Amy, thank you so much. Amy Bix is the author of the new book, Girls Coming to Tech, A History of American Engineering Education for Women. And Janice Marquardt, thank you.
Thank you.
Janice Marquardt is a senior buyer for MidAmerican Energy. We've been talking about women in engineering. And with me now, Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. What's coming up today at noon?
Hi, Charity. Very quickly, of course, 2 weeks before Election Day, we're going to talk about polling on politics today. We'll talk with Ann Seltzer, president of a public opinion research company based in Des Moines, all about polling. We love and we hate them. Charity, I think.
And we're hearing a lot of them these days.
That's
coming
right
up today at noon on River to River. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.